Hoover. At others, it was trapped in the mirrors of a kaleidoscope where each scrap of coloured tinsel was a disjointed fragment of his past life or current existence. In his more lucid moments, Harry knew that given even the best of conditions, his injuries would take time in the healing. He had neither the conditions nor the time. After Shaitan gave him to Scythus, the latter had had him crucified close to the gate. Silver nails held him to the green timbers, and a silver spike passed through him, through his vampire and the trunk of the cross, and out the back where it was bent to one side. As fast as his vampiric flesh worked to repair him, so the silver poisoned him, and he guessed, no, he knew, that he wouldn't come down off this cross alive. At his feet, a bonfire of dry, broken branches confirmed it. A second cross had been erected for Karen. Sometimes she hung there, which impaired her healing processes and kept her servile, and at others she was absent. Harry felt for her most when her cross was empty, for that was when Scythus used and abused her. If he had the strength, the necroscope would talk to her telepathically, except he suspected she would not let him in. No, for she would keep her torments to herself and not add to his despair. But from time to time, when Karen's cross was empty, Harry would look down on Scythus's tent of skins, and the hatred would burn in him like a fire, and then, but far too late, he would wish he'd given his vampire free rein. Perhaps mercifully, such moments of mental clarity, understanding and remorse were few and far between. He didn't remember the arrival of the travellers, called through the pass by Scythus. Loyal in their way to the Vampiri, they were of a fearful, much despised supplicant tribe of gauntlet makers. En route here from Sunside, and obedient to Scythus's commands, they'd stolen away the women and younger men from a party of less subjugated travellers. Also, they had been employed to build the shelters of the vampire lords, and to cut and gather the wood for fires and crosses. Little good any of this did them. Scythus and his monstrous ancestor served all of them alike. They brutalized and impregnated the women, vampirized the pick of the men to be their thralls and lieutenants, and fed the rest to the warriors preparatory to the invasion of the gate. The last was something which the necroscope did remember, the butchery as the last of the travelers tried to flee, and the gluttony of the warriors. Especially he remembered how Scythus, for his amusement, had given a traveller woman to a warrior with the parts of a man. When it was over, and apparently aroused, Scythus had taken Karen down from her cross and into his tent. And when that was over and she was nailed up again, then he had come to gloat at the foot of Harry's cross.
"I've had my fill of your bitch, wizard," he said with a shrug,
as if in casual conversation.
"It was even my thought to lie with her in the open and let you watch. Except, as you've seen, these beasts of mine are frisky. I had no desire to give them ideas. But the next time she comes down off the cross, that will be the last time. And while you are burning, or at least until the skin of your eyes turns black and peel away, you shall see it all. Only a shame that your own agonies must distract from your enjoyment of hers."
Then Harry's hatred had been a greater torture than the nails and the spikes together, so that he was driven back into the darkness of oblivion, but not before he had heard the fallen one's mind warning to his descendant. "Beware, Scythus. Be advised not to drive this one too far. I fancy there's that in him which even he fails to appreciate. Something beyond his control, some weird, instinctive mechanism which works through him. Don't trigger it, my son. Even the travellers, when they hunt and kill wild pigs, are wise enough not to taunt their prey." But in Scythus's secret mind was nothing but scorn. He'd lived through too many auroras just dreaming of these moments of triumph. Taunt this tame pig of a necroscope? Oh, yes, right to the bitter end. Chapter 7. Fusion, Fission, Finale. The Vampiri lords stole more women out of Sunside. With their lust and their bellies satisfied, they slept. Likewise, their beasts and thralls. Sunup gradually approached, and the sky began to lighten over Sunside. When the first soft rains awakened them, before the sun's first deadly rays could shoot between the peaks into Starside and the north, then they would pass through the gate to invade the world beyond. But while they slept, Harry Wolf's son, once Harry Jr., the Dweller, and now the leader of the Grey Brotherhood, padded down from the mountains and through the foothills, and stood off in the shadows to gaze upon the forces of evil where they slept in the gate's glare. He gazed at them and upon the naked human figures crucified in their midst. While the great grey wolf had no way of knowing it, he, his father, and Shaitan the Fallen, all three of them, shared a common problem. Their memories were impaired. But where in Shaitan the deficiency had localized itself and was stable, and where in Harry Sr. it had gradually improved, in Harry Wolfson it grew worse from moment to moment, and would not improve until he was a wolf entire. But for now faint memories stirred, of the woman in the hard ground who had suckled him, of a man on a cross who was his father, and of a girl likewise crucified who had been an ally. Also a battle long, long ago in a place called the Garden, which had been the end of one life and the beginning of another, and of a second more recent battle in the same place, in which he and his grey brothers had no part, but were only observers. He remembered how he had planned to fight in the battle on the side of the two who were crucified, but he didn't remember his reasons. In any case, it would have made no difference. They'd done their fighting in the air, and their warriors were huge, and he and the pack were only wolves. Yet still he felt he'd somehow failed these poor crucified creatures. The man unconscious on his cross, and the woman awake, injured and even resigned now to pain, but not immune from her own black hatred. Back in the foothills, one of the brothers laid back his head and howled at the moon rising over the mountains. In its lower quarter, the moon was golden with reflected light. Soon it would be sunup. Another howl, echoing up to accompany the first, causing Harry Wolfson to issue an instinctive thought.
"Hush! Be quiet! Let the sleeper sleep on!"
His brothers heard him, and so did the Lady Karen.
"Dweller!"
Her thoughts were faint, shielded from the minds of sleeping vampires, but they evoked a flood of memories, however blurred. Harry Wolfson knew she spoke to him.
"I am that one,"
he finally answered, and again,
"I was that one."
But now he must know the truth and asked her,
"Did I betray you?"
"The fight?" A shake of her head and telepathically sensed.
"No, that was doomed from the start. Your father and I, we had already seen our futures. Golden fire burning in the Mobius Continuum. As for our enemies, we thought we'd seen the end of them too. But we were mistaken. For it appears that their futures don't lie here in Starside, but in the world beyond the gate."
Pictures accompanied her words, a scenario straight out of the necroscopes and her own trip into future time, and she wondered if he would understand them. He did, and...
"I'm sorry."
But his memories were sharper now and coming faster.
"My father should have known better. To read the future is a devious thing."
"Aye," she agreed. "I thought the golden fire might be that of the sun, but no, it was only fire. They both burn, it's true, but Scythus's will burn the worst, because it is his. I hate the black bastard."
He saw the logs and branches heaped beneath her.
"Scythus will burn you?
What's left, when his warriors are through with me?"
And even in a wolf's mind, she read horror.
"Is there anything I can do?"
Harry Wolfson came closer, on his belly, creeping between the thralls where they lay in an open circle around the two central black tents.
"Go away," she answered. "Back into the mountains. Save yourself. Become a wolf entire. Eat what you kill and never bite a man or woman, lest they suffer your fate."
"But We were together at the garden,
he said, and in his mind she saw again the fire and death and destruction.
Yes, but you were a power then, you and your weapons.
But no sooner that last thought than suddenly there was another in her head, one of revenge.
Does anything remain of your armory?
His mind was wandering again. He looked this way and that and wondered what he was doing here. His recent pregnant bitch would be hungry where she waited for him.
Armory?
He couldn't remember, so she showed him a picture.
Can you bring me one of these?
Some 200 yards away, out on the boulder plain, a sated warrior snorted in its sleep. Harry Wolfson snaked back into the shadows, loped for the foothills to rejoin the pack. A single thought came back to Karen before the connection was broken.
Farewell.
And hanging there in her pain, in the night and the chill of Starside, she thought,
he won't remember.
But she was wrong. He came again, but barely in time, came with the clouds from the south, with the first warm rain, with the grey light glowing in the sky beyond the mountains. He came with the false dawn before the true dawn of the sun up and braved the circle of thralls where they now scratched and muttered in their sleep. And climbing the logs and branches of Karen's pyre, he stood upon his hind legs face to face as if to kiss her. But her mouth gaped like a gash in her metamorphic face, and what passed between the two was not a kiss.
Wizard, necroscope, wake up!
Harry gave a start as Shythus's thoughts lashed him like a whip. His thoughts and then his spoken words.
Your torment will soon be over, necroscope. So open your eyes and say goodbye to all of this. To your lady, your life, to everything.
Harry's thoughts had something to form an order. His mind was almost healed, his body not nearly so. Silver was present in his vampire blood like grains of arsenic, so that his broken flesh and bones couldn't mend. But he heard Shythus taunting him and felt a splash of rain, and opened his soulful eyes in the dark grey pre-dawn light. Then he almost wished he was blind. Lieutenants of Shythus were up on ladders, bringing Karen down from her cross. Her head rolled this way and that, and her limbs flopped loosely as they tossed her down on a blanket upon the stony ground. Shythus turned from Harry's cross, went to his tent, and slashed through its ropes, collapsing it like a deflated balloon.
And so you see, necroscope, he crowed, how I intend to honour my promise. For perceiving that you now see, hear, and understand all, this time, for the last time, I shall take her in the open. No thrill in it for me, not any more. This time my labours are all for you. And when I'm done, then you shall witness how my warriors deal with her. As well to keep one's creatures happy, for after all, they too were men upon a time.
The rain came on harder, and Shythus issued commands. His thralls ripped the collapsed tent into two halves, then used its torn skin to cover the faggots of the torture pyres. It would not do for them to get too wet. Shythus had meanwhile returned to the foot of the cross. Shitan too, from his own tent. More leech than man, the fallen one's eyes were glowing embers in the shadow of a black corrugated cowl of flesh. It's time, he said, his voice a phlegmy cough, and the gates await. I say, have done with all this. Put the woman on her pyre and burn them. Shythus paused. He was reminded, however, briefly of his old dream. But dreams are for dreamers, and he was weary now of all dark omens, especially his ancestors' warnings.
This man was the cause of my exile in the Icelands, he answered. I vowed revenge, and now I take it.
They glared at each other, Shaitan and Shythus. There in the gates, white dazzle, their eyes blazed where they measured one another. But finally the fallen one turned away. As you will, he said, but quietly, so be it. The clouds were flown and the rain had stopped. Shythus called his thralls to light torches. He took a torch and held it up to Harry on his cross.
Well, Necroscope, and why don't you call up the dead? My ancestor has told me that in your own world you were their champion, and I saw you call up crumbling trogs in the battle for the Dweller's Garden. So why not now?
Harry hadn't the strength for it, which his tormentor knew well enough. But even if he was strong enough, he knew that the dead wouldn't answer him. No, for he was a vampire, and they had forsaken him. But in the foothills behind the gate, a grey shape fretted and whined, prowling to and fro, and the pack watching him intently through feral eyes, where they lay with their tongues lolling and ears erect. The great wolf's memory was imperfect and his nature devolving, but for now he understood the Necroscope's every thought. In a bygone time, as a human infant, Harry Wolfson's mind had been one with his father's. The Necroscope sensed his son there, felt his concern, and at once closed his mind to external screeing. It was an effort, but he did it. Shaitan knew it at once, flowed forward and said to Scythers, "Get on with it. This one's not finished, I tell you. Now he has closed his mind so that we don't know what's brewing in there."
"In just a little while,"
the other snarled.
"His brains will be brewing in there. For now, leave me be."
And again Shaitan backed off.
"Well, Harry Keogh,"
Scythus called up to the crucified man. He waved his torch and tugged aside the skins from the dry branches of the bale fires.
"And did you think to shut me out of your delicious agonies? And can you ignore the pain itself? Ah, we Vampiri have our arts. It's true, we steel ourselves to the throb of torn flesh and the ache of broken bones. Aye, even as they're healing. But the vampire never lived who was insensitive to fire. And you'll feel it too, Necroscope, when your flesh begins to melt."
He reached down with his torch to the base of the pile.
"So, what do you say? Should I light it now? Are you ready to burn?"
And at last Harry answered him, "You burn, you odour of trogs and stench of gas beasts. Burn in hell!" Scythus slapped his thighs and laughed like a madman.
"A taunt for a taunt, eh? What, and do you think to insult your executioner?"
He touched his torch to tufts of kindling, and a wisp of smoke at once curled up, then a small tongue of flame. And in the shadowy foothills, Harry Wolfson issued a ululating howl, then turned and at a fast lope headed downhill for the tableau set in the light of the gate. The Grey Brotherhood made to accompany him, but he stopped them.
"No, return to your mountains. What befalls me befalls."
Flames licked up from Harry's pyre, small bright tongues but gaining rapidly. Scythus went to Charon, where his thralls held her down. She was conscious now, would throw them off, but had no strength for it.
"Necroscope,"
the vampire lord continued to taunt,
"wanderer in strange worlds and stranger places between the worlds. Now say, why don't you conjure one of your mysterious bolt holes and come down from your cross? Step down and challenge me face to face and champion this bitch whose flesh we've both known. Come, Necroscope, save her from my embrace."
Instinctively, Harry's metaphysical mind began to conjure Mobius math. Invisible to all other men, the shimmering frame of a door commenced to form in the eye of his mind, except, of course, it was warped and highly volatile. Only let it develop fully, and all of this would be over. So close to the gate, Harry would probably be shredded and his atoms diffused through myriad universes of light. Maybe that was the answer, the way to go. At least he would be spared the agony of the fire. But what of the agony of others? What of the future agony of the entire world which lay beyond the gate? Too late to worry about that. Earth was already doomed. Or was it? For Harry knew that miracles can happen, and also that they occasionally happen when all seems lost. But in any case, He could always conjure another door, a bigger, more powerful door, when things became unbearable. But...
No,
said Harry Wolfson, in the Necroscope's inner mind, even as he thought to collapse what he'd made.
Hold it there, Father, just for a moment.
And Harry felt his son looking at the Mobius equations where they mutated in his mind, and at the flickering, warping configuration of the part-form door, looking, trying hard to understand, and finally remembering. In another moment the great wolf conjured equations which even Harry, in the fullness of his powers, could never have identified, symbols revenant of a time when the Necroscope's son had been far more powerful than his father. For a few seconds, certain of Harry Wolfson's lost talents were recalled, and, with the effortless skill of all but forgotten times, he used one of them to diffuse through his father's ill-formed door a picture of their here and now, and a warning of possible tomorrows. It sped out from him at an instantaneous speed of thought into all the innumerable universes of light. The Necroscope cancelled his own numbers and let go of the now highly dangerous door, which drifted away from him towards the magnet of the gate. But his son's message and his warning had been transmitted. Harry Wolfson had completed the mental part of his self-imposed mission. All that remained now was the physical. But where the first had been merely improbable, the rest was impossible. That made no difference, not to the great grey wolf, who remembered now that he had been a man. As well, then, to die like a man. In through the encircling thralls he loped, like a wraith appearing from the smoke of Harry's fire, and snarling he made for Scythus, where the vampire lord kneeled beside Charon. But he didn't make it. Lieutenants got in his way. One of them hurled a spear and brought him down. Slathering and snarling, with spears transfixing his breast and emerging bloody from his hackles, still his slender human hands reached spastically for Lord Scythus, until a sword flashed silver and took his head. From his cross, through billowing smoke, through the flames that had not yet reached him, Harry had seen it all.
No!
He cried out loud, and in his mind cried out again,
No! No! No!
And something of his agony, not merely of the flesh but of the soul, went out through the disintegrating Mobius door, which on the instant imploded into the gate. Then a single brilliant prolonged flash of lightning illuminating the peaks, followed by a long, low, ominous drum roll of thunder, and finally a silence broken only by the crackle of bonfire and the spluttering of fresh raindrops striking the flames, until, for the third time, Shaitan came forward.
You cannot feel it, can you?
He sat over his descendant, glared at him for a while, then lifted his head to sniff like some great hound.
The Necroscope has released something into the air and into his secret places, but you feel only your own lust. You've neither thought nor vision for the future, only for what you can take today, and so I warn you one last time, beware, son of my sons, lest you lose us a world.
Scythus's face was twisted in its madness. He was first and foremost Vampiri, and now allowed his vampire full swing. A beast, his hands were transformed into talons. Blood slopped from his great jaws, where his teeth elongated into fangs and tore the flesh of his mouth. With Charon's once crowning, now lusterless hair bunched in his fist, he looked up at Chiton and beyond him to the man on the cross, and his eyes blazed scarlet as he answered,
I should feel something, some weird mystical thing. All I desire to feel is the Necroscope's agony and the flight of his and his vampire's spirit as he dies. But if I can hurt him a little more before he dies, so be it.
Fool!
And a heavy grey mottled appendage of Shaitan's, a thing half hand, half claw, fell on Scythus's shoulder. He shrugged it off and came easily to his feet, and...
Ancestor mine?
He ground the words out.
You have pushed me too far, and I sense that I shall never be free of your interference in my affairs. We'll talk about that shortly, but until then...
With a mind call, he brought forward his warrior out of the shadows, placing the creature between himself and Shaitan the Fallen. Shaitan backed off and gloomed at the warrior, which, in the Icelands, had been Scythus's most recent construct prior to their departure, and inquired of his descendant,
"Are you threatening me?
Are you threatening my life?"
Scythus knew that sunup was nigh and time of the essence. He had none of the latter to waste right now. He would confront his ancestor later, possibly after the fortress beyond the gate had been taken. And so,
"Threatening your life?" he answered. "Of course not. We are allies, the last of the Vampiri. But we are also individuals, with our individual needs."
For which reason Shaitan, in his turn, let Scythus live. For the moment. And as the fire smoked and blazed up brighter, despite a renewed downpour, and as Harry Keogh felt the first breath of heat where flames closed in towards his lower limbs, Scythus again turned his attentions to the Lady Karen. While in another world... It was midnight in the Urals. Deep under the Perchosk ravine, in the confines of his small room, Victor Luchov snatched himself awake from a monstrous nightmare. Panting and trembling, still only half awake, he stood up on jelly legs and gazed all about at the grey metal walls, and leaned on one for its support. His dream had been so real, it had impressed him so badly, that his first thought had been to press his alarm button and call out to the men he kept stationed in the corridor outside. Even now he would do so, except, and as he'd learned only too well the last time, such an action could well be fraught with a terror of its own, especially in the claustrophobic, nerve-racking confines of the Perchosk project. He had no desire to have anyone come bursting in here with the smoking, red-glowing muzzle of a flamethrower at the ready. As his heartbeat slowed a little and while he fumbly dressed, he examined his nightmare. A strange, even ominous thing. In it, he had heard an awful, tortured cry go out from the gate at Perchosk's core, and he'd known its author, Harry Keogh. The necroscope had cried out his telepathic anguish to anyone and all who could hear him, but mainly to the teeming dead in their myriad resting places across the world. And in their turn they had answered him as best they could, with a massed moaning and groaning, even with their soft and crumbling movements, from the airless environs of their innumerable graves. For the dead knew how they had misjudged the necroscope, how they'd denied and finally forsaken him, and it was as if they were grief-stricken and preparing for a new Golgotha. And the departed spirit of Paul Savinkov, a man who had worked for KGB Major Chinggis Kuv right here at Perchosk, worked and died here horribly, had materialized and spoken to the project director in his dream, telling him about the warning which Harry Keogh's son had sent out through the gate. For in life, Savinkov had been a telepath, and his talent had stayed with him, continuing into the afterlife. And seeing in Luchov's mind the nuclear solution to the threat from beyond the gate, Savinkov had told him,
"Then you know what to do, Victor."
"Do?"
"Yes, for they are coming through the gate, and you know how to stop them."
"Coming? Who's coming?"
"You know who?"
Luchov had understood and answered.
"But those weapons may not be used until we are sure. Then, when we can see the threat..."
"It will be too late,"
Savinkov cried.
"If not for us, too late for Harry Keogh. We've all wronged him, and now must make amends, for he suffers needless agonies. Wake up, Victor. It's in your hands now."
"My God!"
Luchov had tossed and turned, but Savinkov had seen that he wouldn't wake. Not yet. But there were others sleeping here. Who would? And then, when Luchov heard the telepath talking again, to whom and what he asked, begged them to do, that was when he'd started awake. Now he was dressed and almost in control of himself, but still breathless, still alert and listening, tuned in to the project's heartbeat, the dull throb of an engine somewhere reverberating softly through the floor, the clang of a hatch echoing distantly, the hum and rattle of the ventilation system. In the old days, the director had been accommodated on the upper levels, much closer to the exit shaft. Up there, it had seemed quieter, less oppressive. But down here, with the Magmus caverns and the core almost directly underfoot, it could be that he felt the entire mountain weighing on his shoulders. Still listening intently, Luchov's breathing and heartbeat gradually slowed as it became apparent that all was in order and it really had been a dream, only a terrible dream. Or had it? That sudden clatter of running footsteps coming closer in the corridor outside and voices shouting hoarse warnings.
Now what in the world?
He went to open the door to the corridor and heard in the back of his mind, like an echo from his dream,
But Victor, you already know! What in the world?
Paul Savinkov's telepathic voice and clear as a bell, except this time it was no dream. A hammering at his door, which Luchov opened with hands that were trembling again. He saw his guards, astonishment written in their drawn, tired faces, and a pair of gaunt technicians just this moment arrived here from the Corps.
Director! Come in, Director!
One of the latter gasped, clawing at his arm.
Director Luchov, I have telephoned, but the lines are under repair.
Luchov could see that the technician was stalling. The man was terrified to report what must be reported, because he knew it was unbelievable. And now, for the first time, there sounded the sharp crack, crack, crack of distant gunshots. At that, galvanized, Luchov found strength to croak.
Is not something from the gate?
No, no, but there are things.
Luchov's flesh crawled.
Things? From under the gate, from the abandoned Magmus regions, and oh God, they are dead things, Comrade Director.
Dead things, the sort of things Harry Keogh would understand, and which understood him only too well, and according to the warnings of a dead man, the worst of it still to come. But hadn't Luchov tried to warn Bayzanov what could happen? And hadn't he advised him to press that damn button right there and then? Well, of course he had, even knowing at the time that the Major didn't fully understand, and that in any case, circumstances didn't warrant it. Also, Bayzanov was a military man and had his orders. Well, circumstances had changed. Maybe now he would put his orders aside and take matters into his own hands. Luchov had experienced and lived through similar disasters before. Now he felt torn two ways. Should he make his escape to the upper levels and abandon the project entirely? Or should he see what could be done down below? His conscience won. There were men down there, after all, just following bloody orders. He headed for the core. As he ran along the angled split-level steel ramp through the upper Magmus cavern to the steel stairwell leading down to the gate, the project director heard the first shouts, screams, and more gunshots from the core. The technicians were right behind him, his own men, too, armed with SMGs and a flamethrower. But as he approached the actual shaft where it spilled light from the gate up into the cavern, so Major Alexei Bayzanov's voice echoed from behind, calling for him to wait. In a moment, the Major had caught up.
I was alerted, he gasped. The messenger was innocent, a gibbering idiot. Can you tell me what's going on, Victor?
Though Luchov hadn't seen it yet, not with his own eyes, still he had a fair idea what was going on. But there was no way he could explain it to Bayzanov. Far better to let him see for himself, so that when he answered,
I don't know what's happening,
his simple lie was in fact a half-truth. In any case, there was no time for further conversation, for as a renewed burst of screams and gunshots ran out, so the Major grasped Luchov's arm and shouted,
Then we'd damn better find out!
A box of plastic eye shields lay at the head of the ramp, just inside the shaft. Bayzanov, Luchov, and his guards each paused to snatch up a pair of tinted glasses before continuing to the core. There they emerged in a group, spreading out onto a railed platform high in the inward curving wall. From that vantage point, looking down on the glaring gate with its reflective perimeter of steel plates, they could take in the entire unbelievable tableau in all its horror. Dead men, once men who had become hideous Magmus composites, whose stench was overpowering even up here, were active in the core, coming up through hatches in the fish-scaled plates, invading the safety perimeter and the rubber-floored area of the missile launcher. There were nine of them, all told, six of whom had already emerged and moved clear of the currently inactive electrical and acid spray hazard area. But such was their nature that Bayzanov could scarcely take in what he was seeing. Again, clutching Luchov's arm, he reeled like a drunkard at the rail of the platform.
For Christ's sake,
What? He mouthed, his eyes bulging as they swept over the madness down below. Luchov knew he need not say anything. The Major could see for himself what these things were. Indeed, he had seen several of them before, down there in the Magmus, when they had been part of the Magmus. Some were rotting, others were mummified, none was composed of flesh alone. They were part stone, rubber, metal, plastic, even paper. Some were inverted, with material folded in, which had tried to become homogeneous with them. They were Magmus, neither pure nor simple, but highly complex, Magmus at its nightmarish worst. One of them, guarding the perimeter walkway, had an open book for a hand. He had been reading a repair manual when the original Perchosk incident happened, and the book had become a permanent part of him. Now, his left forearm mutated into a stiff paper spine at the wrist, and pages fluttering and detaching themselves as he moved. This wasn't the worst of it. The lower half of his trunk had been reversed, so that his feet pointed backwards. Even the plastic frames of his spectacles had warped into his face and bubbled up in crusts of brittle blisters there, while their lenses lay upon his cheeks, where, first, they'd melted, then solidified into tiers of optical glass. And yet, he had been one of the luckier ones. Shut in by Magmus, crushed in the grip of convulsive forces and confined away from the air, he had died instantly, and his fleshy parts had later undergone a process of mummification. But when the Perchosk incident was over and space-time righted itself, others had been left dead and twisted and isolated out in the open, and their conditions had been such that ordinary men just could not bring themselves to tend to them. Fully or partly exposed, occasionally joined to the greater Magmus whole or partly encysted within it, they had simply been left to degrade in areas of the project which were then sealed and abandoned. Eventually, their human parts had rotted down to deformed skeletons, for even bones had been subject to change in those awful moments when matter had evolved to incoherent origins. Bizanov saw men who were part machine. He saw a creature with a face composed of a welding torch jutting from a crumpled oxygen cylinder skull. Another was skeletal from the waist down, but encysted around the chest and head in glassy stone, like a figure in a half-spacesuit. Spiky Magmus crystals were growing out of the fused bone of his legs. Behind the glass of his viewplate, his unaltered face was still trapped in an endless scream. Another was legless, a half-man, which the Magmus warped, had equipped at the hips with the wheels of a porter's trolley. He propelled himself with arms which were black, where scorched flesh had shriveled into the bone. The trolley's long wooden handles projected upwards from his shoulders, like weird antennae framing his head. The twisted mummified hybrids were bad enough, the semi-mechs were worse, but worst of all were those who were partly liquiescent, who but their Magmus parts must simply collapse into stinking ruin. Bizanov had almost stopped breathing. He started again with a gasp and said, "But how and what are they doing?" He turned to one of his terrified technicians. "Why haven't we fried them or melted them with acid?"
"The first one made it to the defense mechanism," the man told him. "He ripped out the wiring. No one lifted a hand to stop him, not then. No one believed."
Bizanov could understand that.
"But what do they want?"
"Are you blind?"
Luchov started down the steps.
"Can't you see for yourself?"
And indeed, Bizankov could see for himself. The nine once men had isolated the Exocet module. They were closing in on it, invading it. Three of the Major's technicians, together with a handful of Perchosk's soldiers, were trying to hold them off. An impossible task. Dead men don't feel pain. Shoot at these Magmus monsters all they would, the launcher's defenders couldn't kill them a second time.
"But why?"
Bizanov came stumbling down the steps after Luchov. Behind them on the platform, the other technicians and Luchov's guards were reluctant to follow.
"What's their intention?" "To press the bloody button," Luchov barked. "They may be dead, warped, weird, but they're not stupid. We're the stupid ones."
At the foot of the steps, the Major caught up and grasped Luchov's shoulder.
"Press the button? Fire the missiles? But they mustn't."
Luchov turned to him.
"But they must, don't you see? Whatever brought them up knew more than we do. The dead don't walk for just anyone or anything.
No, they need a damn good reason to put themselves to torture such as this. Madman,
Bizanov hissed. He was close to breaking.
Oh, quite obviously, this is some long-term alien effect of this totally unnatural place. But these reanimated things can't have any real purpose. They're blind, insensate, dead.
They want to launch those missiles,
Luchov shouted in the other's face over the clamor of discharge weapons.
And we have to help them.
At which the major knew that the project director really was mad.
Help them?
He drew his pistol and pointed it at Luchov's chest.
You poor crazy bastard! Get the hell back away from there!
Luchov turned from him, hurried along the rubber-floored safety perimeter towards the creature with the page-shedding manual hand.
It's all right,
he was gasping.
Let me pass. I'll do it for you.
And to Bizanov's amazement, the thing shuffled aside for him.
Like hell you will,
the major shouted, and squeezed the trigger of his automatic. The bullet hit Luchov in the right shoulder and passed right through, punching out in a scarlet spray from a hole in his chest. He was thrown forward, face down on the walkway, where he lay still for a moment, and Bizanov came on, aiming at him a second time. But the Magmus thing knew an ally when they saw one. The thing with the book hand got in Bizanov's way, blocking his aim, while another, whose limbs were cased in stony Magmus, welded to a trunk, which was a jumble of fused bones, rubber and glass, came lurching to the director's assistance. The major fired at this one point blank, time and time again, to no avail. But as the thing loomed in front of him, finally a shot cracked the Magmus casing of its left arm. The brittle sheath fragmented at once, and a vile black soup, a decomposed mush of flesh, began leaking from inside. Almost overwhelmed by the stench, the major fell against the curving wall. Still, the rotting hybrid came on. Bizanov lifted his pistol and pulled the trigger, and the firing mechanism made a click. He had a spare magazine in his pocket. He reached for it, and the Magmus thing closed a bony hand on his windpipe. Bizanov choked. He could see Luchov getting to his feet, staggering, moving towards the launching module, where most of the defenders had either fainted or stampeded in terror. Only one technician and one soldier remained there now. Their weapons were empty. They danced, gibbered, and clung together like children as decomposing nightmares closed in on them. But Luchov, two of the Magmus composites were helping him, supporting him where he lurched towards the firing console. The major made a final effort, drew the spare magazine from his pocket and tried to fit it into the housing in the pistol grip of his weapon. As he did so, the Magmus sheath fell away completely from his assailant's left arm. Bizanov opened his mouth to yell or throw up, and the anomalous thing stuffed its skeletal arm and envelope of jellied, rotting flesh right down his throat. The major gagged and vibrated where the thing pinned him. His eyes stood out in his head and his heart stopped. He died there and then, but not before he'd seen Luchov at the firing console. Not before he'd seen him slump there and crumple to the rubber floor, even as the klaxons began bellowing their final warning. In Starside, Harry Keogh burned. The rain was a drizzle, which tried but couldn't damp down the flames, and the necroscope burned. He burned inside and out, fire on the outside and a burning, consuming hatred within. For Scheithers, who even now took the Lady Karen by force there in front of Harry's cross, she seemed completely exhausted, resisted not at all as he tore at her. And Harry thought, a beast, even a warrior, could do no worse. But he hoped he'd be dead before that was put to the test. A moment ago he had tried to conjure a Mobius door, the biggest door of all, right there in front of the gate, which, with any luck, would implode massively and suck the vampires and their creatures and all into eternity. But the numbers wouldn't come. The computer screen of his mind had stayed blank. It was as if his skill had died with his wolf son, like a slate wiped clean. And indeed such was the case. After a lifetime of esoteric use, finally Harry's mind had given way, crumpled under the weight of one too many tragedies. Now he was a man again, just a man, and the vampire inside him too immature even to flee his melting body.
Come down, necroscope,
Scheithers taunted.
Should I leave some of this bitch for you?
The flames were licking higher now, the black smoke belching. Shaitan had somehow got round the obstacle of Shaithas's warrior and stood observing all around a short distance. And for all that the fallen one was alien, unmanlike, unreadable, still there was that in his poise, the way his eyes stared out from the darkness of his cowl, which spoke of an almost human uncertainty and apprehension, as if he'd seen all this before and now waited for some awesome termination. Harry's lower trunk was being eaten alive by fire. Now he must sleep and escape from the agonies of life forever. Except, instead of blacking out, suddenly he felt the pain laved away from him, deflected, turned outwards, and he knew that this was not simply an art of the Vampiri. His body burned, but the pain was someone else's. Many someones were absorbing it. All the dead of Starside who, now that it was too late, only desired to comfort him.
No, he tried to tell them, Trogs and travellers alike. You have to let me die.
But his dead speak wasn't working.
Where's your power now?
Shaithas laughed.
If you're so strong, set yourself free. Call up the teeming dead. Curse me with the words of power, Necroscope. Your words, like the dead themselves, are dust.
And somehow, from somewhere, Harry found the strength to answer.
Put yourself aside, Shaithas. The sight of you hurts worse than any fire. These flames are a blessing. They cleanse you from my sight.
Enough,
Shaithas raged, foaming over Charon like a scummy wave.
One last kiss and she's gone, and you with her.
He fell on her, his jaws cracked open. He began to close his mouth over Charon's face to crush her head, and her scarlet eyes opened in blazing life. Perhaps she also opened her mind to let Shaithas read his doom. At any rate, he tried to rear back from her, but no. Her arms and legs were around him, and their metamorphic flesh was welded into one. And, coughing up the dweller's grenade into her throat, Charon pulled the pin with her forked tongue and buried her face in her tormentor's gaping jaw. Shaithas tried to separate from her. Another second and he might succeed. Too late.
Goodbye, Harry, she said,
and the darkness of Starside was split by a single flash of light, accompanied by a detonation only slightly muffled by the flesh and bone, which it turned to grey and crimson pulp. As the red spray settled and their headless, shuddering bodies fell apart, Shaitan flowed forward to stand over them. He ignored Charon, saw only the shell of Shaithas, and reaching a clawed tentacle into the shattered cavity of his descendant's neck, Shaitan drew out his whipping, decapitated leech, drew it out and hurled it into the heart of the bonfire, and laughed. For Shaithas had no head, no brain, and Shaitan had no body. Not the body he wanted, anyway. Not yet.
You fool, he told the empty shell of flesh. And would you set your warrior on me? We were of one blood, you and I. But my grip on the minds of creatures such as these was ever greater than yours. Close on 3,000 years I listened to old Cairol Lugos moaning in his ice-encased sleep, cursing me in his dreams. Did you think I would not notice when suddenly he stopped? Ah, he cursed me, but he was craven too. Did you really think to inspire your construct with his hatred and passions?
What? Old Cairol?
He had a passion, not any longer, and as for hatred!
He turned and hurled a mental dart at Shaithas's warrior, which at once reared up and shrank back, mewling.
You do not know the meaning of the word. What hatred? And how I have hated you! If I had let my jealousy loose, why, I could have killed you 100 times, but never so sweetly as this.
He flowed up to Shaithas, picked up his loosely flopping corpse, and hugged it close. And Shaitan's black, corrugated flesh began to crack open all of its length, like a wrinkled nut displaying its soft kernel. Within the cavity of his ancient trunk, a smaller, more flexible, and yet more durable version of himself, the original vampire, was waiting as it had waited these thousands of years. But Shaitan's plan to join with flesh of his flesh and so be renewed was not to be, for the two Harrys had sent out words of their agony not only into Starside, Earth, and all the worlds beyond, but also into the spaces between them. Their travails were known by all the teeming dead, and their warnings had been heard by others who were not dead and never can be. In the same moment, Shaitan and the Necroscope sensed the one great truth. Harry knew. And Shaitan, finally, he remembered.
Ah!
The fallen one gasped, staggered by the memory. Even as his vampire struggled to be free of the old shell and into Shaitha's, so the eyes under his cowl looked up at Harry Keogh burning on his cross. He looked at his face, framed in fire, and knew where he had seen it before. But now he saw, or sensed rather than saw, it was that swift. Something else, something that flashed silver out of the gate's white glare, and then became an even greater glare as a nuclear sun burst over Starside to briefly rival the dawn. And between the coming of the Exocet and the bursting of its all-consuming warhead, Shaitan saw something else, a sight which might have drawn one last long sigh from the primeval's throat. Except he was no more. It was Harry's cross, but empty now, and pierced by spears of a great light, where at last it was blasted to atoms. Epilogue. Death, Harry wondered why he'd feared it. For all of men, the Necroscope had known it wasn't like that, because he had been there before, incorporeal, bodiless as any dead thing whose flesh has finally failed. He was now free of all of that. Except that in his case, it seemed a mundane death wasn't part of the scenario. He had also known that death wasn't the end, that whatever a man pursues in life, he will habitually pursue in his afterlife continuation. Harry Keogh had been the master of the Mobius Continuum, so it was hardly a surprise to find himself there now, in Mobius time, hurtling back among the blue, green and red threads of Starside into their remote past. A surprise, no, but strange anyway, for in the end he had not conjured a door. He had not contrived an escape. Which could only mean that he'd been rescued. But by whom? And if indeed someone or ones had seen fit to save his incorporeal mind, what possible purpose could he or they have with his burned vampiric body? For as Harry shot back into Starside's past, he saw his separate smoking corpse tumbling alongside, winding back on its scarlet thread to his point of entry into Starside, and then plunging on beyond it. And he went with it, but incorporeal, apart, speeding blindly into times he'd never physically known. As for his ruined shell's destination, and his own for that matter, and the question of whom was their guide? Harry had never in his life been 100% sure, positively sure, about God or a God. But back there in Starside, he'd sensed the arrival, the presence of a power, and he had known that Shaitan sensed it too. Moreover, he had known the source of that power, and also that Mobius and Pythagoras before him had been right. Now, Harry and his exanimate shell was mere impulses in the mind he had called the Mobius Continuum, integers in the infinite matrix of the great unknowable equation. And he wasn't afraid when at long last that mind itself spoke to him.
Things of uses, Harry, always. What use to create if your efforts are only to be wasted? Sometimes we succeed and sometimes we fail, but there are always uses for the best and for the worst of our works.
Harry could tell if an answer had been invited, and in any case he didn't really have one. But he did have a question, however brief.
God?
He sensed a vast shrug.
A creator? An advisor? An angel? God, let's say, he's a few steps higher up the ladder.
His mind, as you know, is vast. We carry his thoughts, expedite his wishes, as best we can.
I've had my doubts, Harry admitted.
So do we sometimes. So did Shaitan, when he was one of us. Except he would have tried to convince everyone that he was right throughout all the universes of light. He would have forced their belief in him.
Harry believed he understood, but understanding should have been enough. But because he was or had been human, and because he saw that his course was veering, angling away from his tumbling corpse, even now he was curious, so that he asked, "What now?"
"Your feet are on the first few runs. You've made your point, chosen your course and stuck to it. You are a success story. We don't believe in waste. We certainly wouldn't waste someone as valuable as you. Like Shaitan, you won't remember, but you will know. Except where he knew only a great darkness, you shall know light in all of your worlds."
"All of my..."
"Wherever you manifest, for his worlds are infinite as his thoughts."
"And that..." Harry indicated his blackened shell where it grew small, tumbling towards some undefined purpose.
"Causes have effects, and effects causes. Nothing may come to pass which has not passed before. The world of Sunside and Starside was a failure where evil won. So maybe a second chance is in order. Also, it will occupy Shaitan, who has balanced himself against light in a great many worlds. Here he begins again on the bottom rung. For as you well know, Harry Keogh, what will be has been. Time is relative."
Harry turned to shrug. With no vampire in him, he was innocent again. The very heart of innocence. "It's all very hard to understand," he said, "but I suppose I'll learn as I go."
"Oh, you will," the other promised.
"And
are you ready?"
Harry's corpse had cartwheeled out of sight into the multi-hued haze of past time. Pure thought, he had no body, no head to nod, but his dead speak nodded for him. And as his incorporeal mind fragmented into a glorious bomb burst, 100 golden splinters breaking up and speeding into as many worlds, his thoughts and even his dead speak were at an end. Except each and every one of those brilliant shards, they were him, and they would know. Starting into awareness, Shaitan cried out. He cried out as he felt consciousness cloaking an intelligence previously bereft, will without knowledge inhabiting a mind wiped clean. He discovered himself kneeling at the edge of stagnant water and saw his image mirrored in scummy depths. And when he saw that he was naked, he was ashamed. But when he saw that he was beautiful, he was proud. For shame and pride are of the spirit, not of intelligence. Standing upright, Shaitan saw that he could walk, and in the twilight of a dim, misty dawn, he moved by the edge of the dark, rank waters, which were a swamp. And he saw how dismal and lonely was this place where he had fallen, or into which he had been cast, so that he knew himself for a sinner, and the place as his punishment. Such knowledge defined his nature, that he instinctively understood such concepts as sin and punishment, and he thought his crime must be that he was beautiful, which was his pride working, which was in fact his crime. For Shaitan saw beauty as might, and might as right, and right as he willed it to be, which was a will he would impose. So thinking, he moved away from the rank waters and went to impose his will upon this strange world. But in the moment he turned away, so the mud bubbled up behind him, and he paused to look back where black bubbles came bursting to the surface. And with the parting of the weeds, Shaitan saw a figure floating up into view. In its body it was bloated and burned, but its face was whole. He knew it for an omen, but of what? He had will. He could wait and discover what would be, or move on according to his will.
Also, he suspected that this thing in the swamp harbored evil. Why else would such an unclean thing be here, in a world which was new? For a moment he stood still, as at a crossroads, then turned back and knelt again beside the swamp, for he had willed it that he would know this evil. He gazed upon a face he had never known, which he would not recall to memory for numberless years, and sensed nothing of the moment except that he tempted fate, which he was proud and glad to do. And as the beasts of this dawn world came to the water to drink, and as the mists were drawn from the swamp, so the fallen one gazed upon his own future, where the weeds anchored it in scum and slime. In a while the scorched, bloated limbs of the corpse split open, and small black mushrooms clustered there, growing out of the rotting flesh and opening their gilled caps. They released red spores into the twilight before the dawn, which, of his own free will, Shaitan breathed. His last act of any innocence. The wheel had turned full circle, and the cycle was closed and opened. This has been Necroscope 5, Deadspawn, written by Brian Lumley, narrated by Michael Troughton. Copyright 1991 by Brian Lumley. Production copyright by David N. Wilson.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.